Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and as always, I appreciate you joining me for a few minutes today as we continue to go through the big old binder of baseball cards from the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and we are this week taking a look at the Dynamite 1972 top set. Yeah, it's attention-grabbing in case you've never looked at a 1972 Topps baseball card, but it certainly jumps out at you. It is very representative of the times, a little more representative of the late 60s, so Topps a little late to the game on that, but it is a design that stands out. It is tacky in many ways, yet despite the faults of 72 Topps, and there are a few of them, this is a set that has had a pretty strong history and a pretty strong life, 45 years in the making now. And it is a collector's favorite for the Carlton Fisk rookie. Also because a few more action shots involved in this set compared to 1971, which we'll talk about. But also because this tacky design, much like everything else from the 1970s that you can declare tacky, it somehow warms your heart to see it, even though it does really kind of bother you. Every time you look at it, you go, wow, that's really, yeah, that's from 1972. Wow, it does stand out at you. So we will look at the monstrous 72 top set, 787 cards, but some very interesting subsets along the way. And we'll also look at the random pull, and this is a fun card and a fun player. Very interesting history behind this player. One of the first 20-game winners in the history of the California Angels, and this was after a disastrous season the year before. Card number 55, Clyde Wright. And Clyde Wright is still bumping around Anaheim. He still works for the Angels. He's been a member of the Angels organization since 1966 when he made his major league debut with the club. And I love this picture of Clyde Wright, and we'll talk a little more about that when we take a peek at the individual card and the story of Clyde Wright, which is a very interesting and, I should add, inspirational story. First, let's take a look at what you're talking about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, your 24/7 home for baseball card talk. You could talk about the sets that we discuss. You could talk about the players that we talk about, or you can respond to, you know, things that I say in the podcast or things that other people say. Or sometimes the conversation just kind of goes off kilter, and that's really the most entertaining conversations. And we had one just in the past couple of days. But looking at the timeline for Wax and Gum Stains, and again, I encourage you to share Wax and Gum Stains with your friends, collectors from back in the day or people who still collect now. I think there's something for everyone on this Twitter feed, of course, the latest episodes of Wax Ecstatic. We notify you of those through this. But looking back at the 71 Topps replies, we looked at Darren Johnson and the 71 Topps set in last week's episode. And unlike the 1970 Topps set, where I got quite a few people upset with my take on the set, it's not a bad set, but I put it in the category of good, not great. And we had quite a few people who said, no, it's a great set. It's one of my favorites. So again, you know, to each his own. I'm not saying that I'm right here. It's just my opinion. And we certainly encourage your opinion to be voiced here and have a nice open discussion. That's a nice change from how things are being done today, right? By the way, happy 4th of July. Hopefully our nation is still plugging along when you're listening to this podcast. I know when our forefathers signed the Declaration of Independence 241 years ago, this is exactly how they thought it would play out. So anyways, speaking of mending fences, while we didn't have too much consensus on the 1970 set, 1971, no doubt a lot of fans still love this set. Jeff Farnham, I have some of these cards still in my collection, and I think that was even before the tweet went out that had our podcast. Yeah, it was one of those preview tweets, and he was pretty excited about that. Cardboard Clubhouse, this is my favorite set of the 70s, and one of my top five favorites ever. Now, I know we differ on the 1970 Topps discussion, but Cardboard Clubhouse, I agree with you. If you look just at the 1970s sets, 71 Topps has to be the number one set in most collectors' opinions. Now, for some people, it may be a little different. Maybe you like the more simple design of like a 70 or a 74 or a 78. Or, you know, as we discussed in the last show, maybe your birth year is in the 70s, so you have a soft spot for a set that maybe not other collectors do, but because you were born that year, you like that set. And for me, it's 77 tops. I was born in 1977, and, you know, I've always had this affinity to that set. But regardless of your emotions towards one particular set or another, when you look at all of the 1970s sets, without a doubt, 71 tops, I would say probably 95% of collectors would say that is the best set of the 1970s. I honestly couldn't tell you what the runner-up would be, or that 5% that don't agree with me, because, you know, there are some decent sets in the 70s. There are some clunkers and pretty wild ones in the 70s, but most collectors do agree that 71 is the best set of the 1970s. Exposed, one of my favorite Who tunes, and he is talking about the tweet that we sent out. In fact, it was the first one, as the Who once said, "Let's see action." And we're talking about, you know, a little play on words there with the action shots that really made their debut in the 71 set in base cards, not just action shot subsets, but in base cards. And there's a reason why I put that in there, because I love that song too. I mean, I love the Who. Been very fortunate to see them in concert once. In fact, it was the last U.S. tour that John Entwistle was on before he passed away. And he died in, I think it was 2004 or 2003. And Boris the Spider, watching John Entwistle just pluck away at the bass during that song was awesome. But yeah, Let's See Action. So glad you caught the little reference there. Of course, I did mention in the tweet that it was The Who, but I'm glad that you enjoy that song as much as I do. That is a very underrated Who song. And for those of you too young to know The Who or care about The Who, and in fact, you're going, Who? Just go to YouTube, type in Who, Let's See Action, and give it a listen. I think you'll like it. And it's actually, it's one of those songs that still you could apply to today's problems in society and politics and you name it. Waxpack 916, great show. Listen to this and 70 tops while on the drive to DC. It makes the drive go a lot quicker. And I know you said you were going to try to get to a Nationals game. I hope you got there. And if you did, please share any pictures or stories that you have on our Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed. I would love to follow along with you on that. Sleep Frank, speaking of 72 tops, pick this up for 75 cents. Aaron and Stargell, 1971 NL home run leaders. So Willie Stargell was your number one home run leader. Hank Aaron was your number two. And you guess who number three for the National League was in 1971? Lee May of the Cincinnati Reds, another great cog in the Cincinnati Reds' big red machine that a lot of people tend to overlook. We all remember Bench, and we all remember Rose, and we all remember Concepcion, and you know, there's others that jump out at you, Tony Perez and George Foster, but Lee May was one of the ones in the early part of the decade who helped power the big red machine. So thank you for sharing that. And one last thing, I've got to thank, well, first of all, this is a great Twitter name, Dr. Funky Butt Lovin'. All right. Stratty D is the handle, but if you're a funky butt lover, then, you know, to each his own. Different strokes for different folks, right? He sends this picture, and he says he lives, and he tagged a few other people, including us. It's it's a real estate sign, and it says Billy Martin, and there's the phone number for real estate agent Billy Martin. And the sign that dangles from it, it's Closing Time Realty. So apparently the second coming of Billy Martin is also a Semisonic fan. That's cool. So we had some fun with this. Baseball card backs, not real. The real Billy Martin never accepted that it was closing time. Yes, absolutely. I replied with, you know, going on the closing time mantra. He wouldn't let Sparky Lyle close the deal. Yeah, If you've read anything from the Bronx Zoo, it was obvious that Billy preferred putting Goose Gossage into most closed situations, much to the chagrin of Sparky Lyle. Craig Mergenthal. Somehow Steinbrenner has fired this guy multiple times, too. Yes. And Dr. Funky Buttlovin. Oh, geez. Stratty D. says, I know all us baseball geeks would dig this. Good people. Yes, thank you so much for sharing that. That is a really, really funny picture there. And, you know, if Billy Martin could actually sell some homes, I wouldn't be surprised if he did. You know, back in the day when Billy Martin was playing ball, not managing, but playing ball, ball players had to hold second jobs. They had to hold winter jobs because the baseball jobs did not pay that well and would not pay well until the mid to late 70s. I would love to see Billy Martin try to close out a house. Could you imagine if Reggie Jackson was out on the closing date and he tried to muscle his way in and, you know, Billy would be throwing punches at Reggie like they did in Fenway Park back in 77. Oh, good stuff there. All at Wax and Gum Stains, thank you again for your comments and for sharing everything else on our Twitter feed. Now, don't forget, we've got new episodes of Wax Ecstatic every Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock. Yes, even on holidays, we will throw one out to you. And you can listen to them on Audio Boom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, or Stitcher. And again, if you follow Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter, we send you the direct links to our Audio Boom page. And we will have a new auction with the holiday weekend. I wanted to give it a few days, but also, you know, like I said, last episode, I spent several days in Chicago for the NHL draft. So it took me a few days to kind of get back into action at work and kind of get everything lined back up into a holiday weekend. So, you know, we skipped it last week, but we do have up for bids later this week, two packs of 83 Fleer, two wax packs. And we will put that up there, probably just put a starting bid, keep it low, probably about $5, and let people bid away at those. Now, Andrew, a listener in San Diego, won our 84 Tops Rack Pack auction a couple weeks back, and he hit it big time. Like, every good card you could imagine in 84 Tops came out there. We had the Tony Gwynn card that was visible on the back of one of the rack cells. But then in the third cell, we found the Don Mattingly rookie. And yeah, I know it's not worth as much now as it was 25 or 30 years ago, but it's always cool when you land the big card in a set. So we're sending those off to Andrew. So he hit it big with 84 Tops Rack. Will you hit it big with a couple of 83 Fleer wax packs? Who knows? Can't guarantee anything, but it's always fun to open up the old wax packs and find some hidden gems in there. And this is something we've been doing for a few weeks. We found some success for it. And it looks like most people really clamor for the late 70s and early 80s stuff. So I will try to procure a few more of those items over the next few weeks. I can tell you we've got some 85 top cellos that we'll put up within the next couple weeks. And like I said, we'll see what comes in over the next several weeks, and we'll put them up for auction. Right now, doing it once a week, but we may scale that back, may do it once every 10 days or whatever. Just kind of depends on the reaction and how fans are looking forward to that. So we've had a few breaks. We did, let's see, 81 Tops grocery rack, which had a couple decent cards in there. We had a 77 Tops wax pack, which unfortunately didn't yield any big cards there. And then the 84 Tops rack pack, like I said, got the Gwynn, got the Mattingly, and a handful of other pretty decent cards. Well worth what Andrew paid for it. I'll just leave it at that. All right, let's take a look at the 72 Tops set. As I mentioned at the close of our last episode on 71 Tops, there's a whole lot of Sid and Marty Krofft, H.R. Puffin stuff, Electric Company feeling in 72 Tops. This is a very loud set. True story, I learned about the definition of the word gaudy through 72 Tops. No joke. When I was a kid, I was reading some price guide or baseball card book, and they were talking about 72 Tops, and they called it gaudy. and I had no idea what gaudy was. And that's how I learned about the word gaudy and its meaning through 72 Tops. So it is a very gaudy set. As I said earlier on in the show, it is delightfully tacky. And I hope the people from Hooters are not listening, because that may be a trademark phrase. But this is a set that actually has a lot of things that aren't very good about it. In fact, there's some things about the colors, about the design, some of the pictures that are used. It's actually a fairly average, and you may argue below average set for a number of reasons. But like I said, it represents something extremely tacky from an extremely tacky decade, the 1970s. And if there was ever a time of an explosion of color and artwork and that whole electric company, Sid Marty Krofft type stuff that I was talking about, it was 1972. It was a very wild and trippy, groovy looking time when you're looking at marketing and advertising and promotional stuff. And if Topps goal is to create a card that really captures the look and feel of the time, and I've heard, you know, through various sources that that is something that the Topps company tried to do throughout its history. 72, they nailed it. And I thought so too in 71. I thought they really, even though you had the black borders and it was kind of dark and artsy, that was still very representative of the times. Well, 72 is almost the exact opposite in conservatism to 71. But it does represent 1972 extremely well. And because the 72 top set overall design is very gaudy, is very loud, it literally jumps out at you with some 3D artwork here. A lot of collectors look past the faults of this set and they love it. And the best thing I can liken it to is some of the uniforms that you saw in Major League Baseball in the 1970s, notably the Tequila Sunrise jerseys of the Houston Astros. Now, those wouldn't debut until 1975. But when the Astros put those on, and they do wear them once or twice a year for throwback days, people love watching it. They love seeing the colors and the design of a bygone era. And a lot of people have mimicked the 75 Houston Astros uniforms. Especially colleges, but even high schools. And even Paul Lucas had a very special story on the history of the Houston Astros uniform. And even though that was loud and obnoxious and jumped out at you, it's still a fan favorite because it was loud and obnoxious and jumped out at you. Same can be said for all the brown and gold uniforms of the San Diego Padres in the 70s, the various light blue, powder blue road uniforms that popped up in the 1970s. Even the stodgy Boston Red Sox by the mid-70s, you know, ditched their classic look for the double knit uniforms and the bright red caps with the dark blue B on it. And, you know, that's just how big the color and design of the 1970s was taking over baseball at the time. When you could have a team like the Red Sox pull that off, when you had the White Sox do their like 1910 style jerseys in the late 70s, the Pittsburgh Pirates, of course, the We Are Family, Stargell Star, you know, Bumblebee uniforms from the mid to late 70s. These are all uniforms, when you look at them, you go, wow, this hurts my eyes. I probably shouldn't be staring at these too long. But because they are just so, again, delightfully tacky, there's a little bit of a love-hate relationship. And even if you're not a big fan of those particular uniforms, you kind of give an exception. It's just like, well, it was the 70s. You know, that's the excuse for a lot of things, right? Oh, look at those powder blue baseball uniforms. Ah, it was the 70s, you know? Hey, Nixon had a bunch of guys break into the Watergate Hotel. Ah, it was the 70s. Come on. You know, oh, these prominent people used to snort buckets of cocaine up their nose. Ah, it was the 70s. Come on. You do the same thing with 72 Tops. You look at it and you go, wow, this looks like a Haight-Ashbury concert poster. Ah, it was the 70s. Come on. It's 1972. You know, electric company. Yeah. Or that board game Payday, if you're old enough to remember that. That came out of the early 70s. Or the early episodes of Sesame Street. That was a very trippy show to watch back in the day. So it is very, very representative of 1972. So as much as we mock the gaudiness of 72 Tops, well, we also mock the gaudiness of, you know, the ugly Astros uniforms and the Padres brown and gold and all those other examples I gave. It's just something that, looking back on it 40 plus years later, you go, yeah, that was pretty tacky, but, you know, it wasn't that bad. 72 Tops definitely fits that bill. And let's take a look at the individual card as we are looking at card number 55, Clyde Wright, our random pull here. Let's look at the front of the card. Now, much to the delight of collectors, Tops went from the black borders in 71 to the white borders in 72. Now, that helps us out tremendously in trying to keep these cards in halfway decent shape. Even though the 71 top black borders were very striking and artistic, they're just a real pain to try to keep in any semblance of mint condition. In fact, 46 years later, it's damn near impossible to do. You would have had to have taken a key card from 1971, pulling it from a pack, either in 1971 or recently, and then just had to put it under glass since, because those cards have been handled quite a bit. So you do have a noticeable white border, but the part of the card that stands out is that concert poster style design, the inner border, if you will. And, you know, here on this Clyde Wright card, you have Angels! And you even have these little stars. You know, it's kind of like a Stevie Wonder album cover. It's just leaping right out at you. Angels, everybody. Now, this is actually somewhat easy to read, but when you got to teams that have a lot of letters in their names, especially White Sox, Red Sox not really, but White Sox especially, the Athletics, they didn't even put Athletics. They just put the A's up there, and that made it a lot easier to see. But teams that have more than seven or eight letters in their names, the design did not really work real well for them because it all kind of clustered together. It's kind of hard to read. And also the mixture of various colors in here. Some teams stood out. For example, you have on the orange background, you've got the black angel letters with the really nifty lime green and aqua blue mix of colors here. This stands out. But there are some other cards, like I said, the color combinations just don't work because the letters are in too tight or because of the gray cardboard stock. It just doesn't mesh real well. So that's actually, again, one of the faults of 72 Tops that people tend to overlook because of the rather gaudy overall design. Now, even though there's a lot of gaudiness, there's a lot of cleanness too, believe it or not. So we have the comic book concert poster, Electric Company, Sid Marty Krofft team name leaping out at you. But at the bottom, you have this nice little oval with the player's name, and that's it. There's no position. There's no team logo. There's just nothing. This, in fact, looks an awful lot. I've mentioned concert posters, but even like, you know, an old stained glass window almost, you know, very simple design where you have that, you know, gaudy name jumping out at the top, but the player's name is very simply put in this little oval at the bottom, and that is it. So even though we mock 72 Tops for a lot of reasons, there's some surprising simpleness to this, and I actually like that. Now, I love the picture here of Clyde Wright, who you'll find out in just a moment is a little bit of a goofball. Now, we talked about in 71 Tops how you had a clash of the old and new in the Darren Johnson card, because here's Darren Johnson wearing the new Philadelphia Phillies uniforms of 1970, the maroon and white pinstripe uniforms that represented the Phillies throughout the 70s and 80s as well. It was the first major overhaul of the Phillies uniform system since, I think, the late 40s. Very modern. And you have this very modern look in front of the very old spite fence in Shy Park. And that was the last season that the Phillies would play in Shy Park. Well, here on this card, you've got a pretty interesting clash of worlds here. First of all, you have one of my favorite baseball uniforms of all time. And this is the only season the Angels wore this particular uniform. And that is with the lowercase a with the halo. And you can't really see it on this card, but you can look up pictures of it. The word Angels on the front of the uniform also has the lowercase a. Now, this is the biggest overhaul of the Angels uniform since they started in 1961. The biggest change, of course, was changing from LA to CA on the hats to represent Los Angeles to California when they moved right before they moved into Anaheim Stadium. They actually changed their name in 1965, their last season at Chavez Ravine in L.A., and then they moved into Anaheim Stadium in 66. So this was a pretty notable change. Yet, sadly, in my opinion, the Angels didn't keep it long enough. In 72, they would change the cap logo and the letter A on the uniform to the uppercase A. Now, it was rather appropriate because Anaheim Stadium was called the Big A. And as you can see in the background of this picture, before they enclosed the stadium in 1979, there was a gigantic A-shaped scoreboard in left center field. Now, you can't see the whole thing here, but if you have never seen a picture of the entire scoreboard in the old version of the Anaheim Stadium, Google image it. It's a thing of beauty. It was a very simple yet artistic standout piece of that ballpark. Now, the Big A scoreboard still lives today, but it's been moved out to the parking lot near the freeway, and instead of a scoreboard, it's basically used as a message board. But the Big A is still there. But from 1966 to 1978, this was a very, very unique part of Anaheim Stadium. And I love that you can see that in this picture here, including the free advertising for Chevron F310 gas, because Clyde Wright's kind of goofing around here. And that leads me to just the general quality of the photo. Clyde Wright is, you know, kind of doing one of these faux action shots that Topps was very famous for throughout the 1960s. And he looks rather awkward here. It looks like he's actually just stumbling to the ground. But it's kind of a funny transition here because you saw some more action shots in 72 Topps, but not necessarily to the base card. 72 Topps had a subset called In Action. And it wasn't actually just a subset. They were just kind of sprinkled throughout the set. And those were the action shot cards. And one of the reasons why the set grew by over 80 cards from 71 to 72. So you would see this kind of growth from faux action to real action. But in the base cards of 72 Topps, they kind of held back a little bit. Now, they would go all out with action shots, especially in 73 Topps. You'd see it in 74 as well. And in 73, as we'll discuss next week, they had some laughably awful action shots that were used. Of course, this is before the day of super zoom lenses. So you often had action shots of a guy, you know, making a play at second base, but the photographer who is back in the stands, they used a picture of the entire infield. So there's, you know, five guys running around on the infield and, you know, this card is made for one player and you've got to kind of search around and pick him out there. So Topps would, you know, kind of lose control over the action cards in 73. But here you've got Clyde Wright, the willing participant, kind of goofing off here with the faux action shot. Now let's flip the card over. This is one of the downsides to the 72 Topps set. It is not very easy to read. You've got the gray cardboard stock, but also this dark orange background and the black print for most of it. Now, when the black print is on the gray portion of the card, it's pretty easy to read. But as for the orange part, you do have to squint just a little bit. And Topps going with the full career record here for the player, you know, going back to what they did prior to 1971. And even though I always appreciate the full list of stats here, it's just very hard to read with the dark gray cardboard stock. And again, the black and the orange, it doesn't really stand out real well. So if you can squint a little bit and read the card, you'll see the card number in the upper left-hand corner. You have the player's personal information in this very 70s style. Again, you know, the curvy box look here. upper left-hand corner. You've got a little cartoon in the upper right-hand corner, a little trivial factoid in the middle in the gray box, and then the stats in the orange box. So again, this is something that is not very good. It does not come together real well in this set, but because the front of the card really steals the show, a lot of people forget about the backs of the 72 Topps cards and they kind of give it a pass. So, you know, once again, it's one of those, it was the 70s. You know, you're so enamored by the concert poster, you can't read the fine print on the back. So I'm not a big fan of that, but overall, the design of the 72 Topps card, again, the term I have to use or the phrase is delightfully tacky. In many ways, this is just an ugly-ass card. This is definitely not modern in 2017 terms. It is, however, modern in 1972 terms. And because of that, there is an affection towards this particular card and this particular set because it does stand out. And there is no doubt, and I've said this before, if you were to take just the template design of this card and plug in a current player or a current team, it will stand out and you will know automatically, this is 72 Topps. There's no doubt about it. You don't have to think twice about what year this particular set may be. Now, as for the set itself, 787 cards. This was a huge set for the time, still released in several series. Now, not released in seven series. They released it for some reason in six series back then, but like a lot of card sets that were released in several series in the 1950s and 60s and into the early 70s, the higher series cards are a lot harder to come by, in particular series 5 and 6, and that is because a lot of retailers, if they weren't able to move series 1, 2, and 3 off the shelves, they were going to order fewer and fewer boxes of series 5, 4, 5, and 6 wax packs and you name it. Also, because it was later in the year, if you had tuned out from baseball and started paying attention to football or one of the other fall sports like basketball or hockey, chances are you may miss out on the last series of a set there. And, because of that, you know, again, retailers tended to pull back on ordering wholesale if they couldn't get it off their shelves quick enough. Now, there are some pretty unique subsets. As I mentioned, you have the in-action cards that are all throughout the set, and those feature, as you would imagine, the players in action. And as we mentioned in the 71 Topps podcast, the action shots weren't always flattering action shots because you didn't have the extreme zoom lenses that caught 10, 20 frames with the push of a button. It was a little primitive back then, so you often would see a guy, you know, swinging at a ball, but clearly you look at his body language, he's struck out or he's missed the ball. Or sometimes you have a pitcher just kind of standing on a mound, you know, not very flattering shots in many cases. But still, that was Topps' commitment to shaking things up and providing more and more action shots in 72 in a subset as opposed to the base cards. Now, 72 Topps also featured the first traded cards. These were the last several cards, or not the last several cards, I should say. It was a little earlier in the series, but there are seven cards from the sixth series that feature prominent players who were traded either right before or in the beginning of the 72 season. The most notable is Steve Carlton going from St. Louis to Philadelphia. And those cards are a little different. You don't have the big, you know, Shazam team name jumping out at you at the top. You actually get the full frame and you get the player's name at the bottom. But across the lower third of the picture, you have this military style traded stamped on to the card here. So there's no doubt that Steve Carlton was traded in this particular card in the 72 top set. Now, with that said, another curious part of the 72 top set, and this harkens back to the 70 top set, you had another team relocate, and for some reason, Topps did not try to update the photographs of some of the players in the set. The Washington Senators moved to Dallas-Fort Worth after the 1971 season. They became the Texas Rangers. And unlike the Seattle Pilots, who moved literally a handful of days before the 1970 season started, they moved to Milwaukee and became the Brewers. The Senators, it was a fait accompli. They knew Their fans knew that they were leaving. Their owner, Bob Short, in September of 1971, made the announcement he was going to move the team to Dallas-Fort Worth. In fact, the final home game for the Senators at RFK Stadium was a forfeit, I believe, to the Detroit Tigers because fans got rowdy and they all hated Bob Short and they started trashing the stadium. So the game had to be called and forfeited. Against the Senators. So that's a rather dubious way to end your time in Washington, D.C. So understandably, the first series, maybe even the first two series, you would expect that Topps wouldn't be able to have new pictures of the Rangers players. In fact, you see a lot of airbrushed shots, and you also have the usual old trick of the picture of the player from taken down from beneath his chin and kind of looking up, so you see the bottom of the bill of his cap and not the logo. But for whatever reason, even though it was obvious that the Senators were leaving Washington for Texas, they didn't even try to update the cards in the later series of the sets when they could have had some pictures of the Texas Rangers in action. In fact, the Texas Rangers team card, and in 72 Tops, they took the team photo cards, or took the team photo, I should say, from the year before and dressed it up as the team card. So if you look at 72 Tops, the card that says Rangers, it's actually the 71 Washington Senators team photo. So that's a little bit of an awkward thing there. But, for some reason, they just did not try to update the Texas Rangers cards like they did all of the expansion teams back in 1969. You had your typical airbrush and capless and below the cap shots for the first couple of series. But as the series moved on, you saw pictures of the Seattle Pilots and the Montreal Expos and the San Diego Padres and the Kansas City Royals. For some reason, they just didn't do that in 72. And that's mystifying because, again, with the Brewers or the Pilots relocation becoming the Brewers in 1970, you could understand that because that happened right before the season started. But they knew about the Senators well in advance. And for whatever reason, they just didn't try to update that. So if you're looking for your first true set of Texas Rangers cards with Rangers players and Rangers uniforms, you'd have to wait until 1973. Now, another interesting subset in the 72 top set is the Boyhood Photos of the Stars. And this was kind of neat. You know, and Topps would do something like this throughout the 70s. They would have pictures of players then and now. So sometimes you would see boyhood pictures and then when they were grown up, or if it was a veteran player, you know, like Willie Mays, you'd have a picture of him in 1973 and then a picture of him in 1953. And, you know, Topps would always do these historical type cards every now and then. Well, this was similar to that. In the lower right hand corner of a card, you would have a color photograph of the current player. And the bulk of the card was a black and white photo of the kid doing something, or the player doing something as a kid, I should say. And you had some pretty interesting ones. One of my favorites, which I do have, is the late Jim Fregosi. And it's not Jim Fregosi, a childhood photo of him, you know, playing baseball or any other sport. It's Jim Fregosi playing the accordion. So you had some pretty interesting insight into the youthful days of these kids. Speaking of Jim Fregosi, 72 Tops, the first card with Nolan Ryan wearing an Angels uniform, although it is airbrushed on. You can clearly see that he is wearing a Mets uniform with the pinstripes and the Angel cap was painted on. And the big rookie card in 1972 is the Carlton Fisk card. It is one of those three-panel cards, so Fisk's first solo card wouldn't be found until 1973, but this is the one card that really does carry some weight behind it. And there are some other notable rookies, certainly not at the status of Carlton Fisk, but we should mention Dave Kingman, Chris Chambliss, also the Penguin, Ron Say, and Mickey Rivers are standout players. Now, much like Nolan Ryan has a rookie card with Jerry Kuzman, so if you were a fan of Jerry Kuzman and you wanted his rookie card, you were shelling out a couple grand to get that card from 68 Tops. The Carlton Fisk rookie card is also shared by Cecil Cooper. So if you were a big fan of one of the most underrated first basemen in the 1970s, not just with Boston, but later with Milwaukee, you're going to be shelling out a pretty penny for that. Mike Garman, by the way, the other player featured on that card, just in case you were wondering. So 72 Tops overall, it's a huge set, and it's got a lot of interesting subsets. It's got a lot of interesting players in here. You've got a rather neat mix of, you know, up and coming stars, like we mentioned, you know, the Carlton Fisk rookie card, other big stars that were just starting to make a name for themselves. You look at Reggie Jackson, you look at, you know, Pete Rose had been around for 7 or 8 years then, but you also have the swan song cards, or maybe not the final card, but some of the later cards for some of the biggest legends of the game at the time. Willie Mays wearing a Giants uniform. Of course, he would be finishing out his career with the Mets over the final couple seasons of his career, but also Roberto Clemente. And even though Clemente's final card was in the 73 Tops set, the 72 Tops card is rather haunting for a couple of reasons. One, because he would, of course, die on New Year's Eve 1972 in that humanitarian aid project for the residents of Nicaragua after an earthquake. But also the picture that's used in the 72 Tops, Roberto Clemente, very haunting. He's just kind of looking down, tossing a ball in his hand. It's just, you know, there's a very somber feel to the card, but it's very powerful. It's actually a very neat card. So that's one of those cards you could probably get relatively cheap because it's not a 62 or not a 58 Roberto Clemente. You know, it's a 72, so there's plenty more of them, and it's also very late in his career, but it's a very, very neat photograph, and I encourage you to check out a picture of it if you get a chance. Just Google image 72 Tops Roberto Clemente, and I think you'll agree with me. It's a very powerful and haunting photograph of the late Pittsburgh Pirates outfielder. Now, as for our random pull, card number 55, Clyde Wright, a very interesting story and a very interesting career. And if you look at his career numbers, a record of 100 wins, 111 losses, a 3.50 earned run average. Let me look at the strikeout-to-walk ratio here. Almost 1-to-1, 667 strikeouts, 550 bases on balls. Nothing stands out when you look at the career lines, but he did have some pretty interesting moments in his career, and most notably after his career, which is mostly why he is still alive. Now, he would make his major league debut in 1966 against a pretty powerful Minnesota Twins lineup. And he was able to beat the Twins in his debut. And he did so with such frustrating efficiency that he picked up the nickname Skeeter. Now, he's from Johnson City, Tennessee, so, you know, he's a Southern boy. So they said that his ball was as lively as a Skeeter. So from then on, Clyde Wright was known as Skeeter. And he would have a decent but relatively unassuming career, and especially in 1969. You look at his stat line from there. He had a win-loss record of 1-8, a 4.10 earned run average. And again, we look at the strikeout-to-walk ratio in 1969. That was practically 1-for-1, 31 strikeouts to 30 bases on balls. But something amazing happens. He does some winter league baseball under the tutelage of Jim Fregosi, who would later become a manager in the major leagues. And he learns how to use a screwball along with, you know, a couple other pitches he picks up along the way. Well, Clyde Wright comes back to the Angels in 1970. And with this screwball and with this whole new assortment of pitches, he becomes one of the most dominant pitchers in the American League. And for a long time, he was the most dominant left-hander in Angels history. His one and only All-Star season in 1970, and he would actually pick up the loss in the 1970 All-Star game in Cincinnati through no fault of his own. That was a game that went into extra innings and is best remembered for Pete Rose barreling into Ray Fosse at home plate, and that totally ruined Fosse's career. But, you know, Clyde Wright had an All-Star season where he went 22-12, a 2.83 earned run average, and 110 strikeouts to 88 bases on balls. And he would have a Mets and Mets of 71 season. He goes 16-17, but 2.99 earned run average. And again, the old strikeout to walk ratio, 135-82. He would rebound in 1972 with an 18-11 season, but then the bottom drops out in 1973. Now, keep in mind, because we don't want to trash Clyde Reich here, the California Angels, despite having Nolan Ryan on their team and a very young Frank Tanana coming up through the system and some pretty decent players, overall, the California Angels teams in the early 70s were not very good. They were, you know, they had a few standout players, like I said, but overall, they were not a very competitive team. So, you know, you don't want to really harp on Wright for that 11-19 season, but clearly that stands out as a dark mark on his career. Well, he gets traded by the Angels in 1973 in a big deal to the Milwaukee Brewers. He's traded along with Steve Barber, Ken Berry, Art Kuznier, and Cash to the Brewers for Ollie Brown, Joe LaHoud, Skip Lockwood, Ellie Rodriguez, and Gary Ryerson. So a big nine-player trade there. And you would think, all right, well, maybe he just needs a change of scenery. Well, if the early 70s Angels teams were bad, the early 70s Brewers teams were absolutely abominable. And much to the chagrin of Clyde Wright, he betters, or should I say worsens, his record, goes from 11-19 to 9-20. Yes, one of the few modern-day pitchers to suffer 20 losses, as an earned run average of 4.42. And then things wouldn't get better for him in his career from there. After the 1974 season, he's traded to the Texas Rangers for Pete Broberg. And if the early 70s Brewers teams were abominable, the 1975 Texas Rangers were an absolute train wreck. That was the team that Billy Martin got fired from. Frank Lucchesi, one of his coaches, would take over as the manager. And despite Martin getting the Rangers within one game of the playoffs in 1974, they were on the Oakland A's tail all the way to the very end. He couldn't keep it all together in Texas in 75. And Clyde Wright, near the end of his career, one of the reasons why, with 4 wins, 6 losses, and a 4.44 earned run average. And while his Major League Baseball career started going downhill quickly in 73, 74, and 75, it starts hitting rock bottom when he goes to Japan in 1976. He's playing for the Yomiuri Giants, and he has a tiff with their manager, Shigeo Nagashima. Wright is getting pulled out of game in a sixth inning. He doesn't feel like he should be pulled from the game. It was a 1-1 game at the time. So he, you know, angrily leaves the mound, throws the ball into the stands, goes into the clubhouse, and trashes the clubhouse, where he then earns the nickname through the Japanese media, Crazy Wright. Oy. Now, despite this rather ignominious event, he was actually able to get back together with the manager, and they were able to smooth over the ruffled feathers. And he was actually a very productive pitcher for the Giants for the next 3 seasons. Unfortunately, off the field, he starts developing a very bad drinking habit to the point where he was an alcoholic. And in a story that he shared with the Los Angeles Times back in 1996, he said that his wife, Vicky, gave him an ultimatum in 1979. Now, he had moved back stateside. His pro career is done. And again, this is one of those interesting, you know, adjustments that players have to deal with afterwards. You know, your career is done. In Wright's case, at the age of 38, you know, all you've known in your life is playing baseball. Well, what do you do now? Well, if you're already an alcoholic and then you're dealing with this crisis of, well, what do I do with my life? You know, most people are ascending in their careers at the age of 38 and I'm dead in the water. So, you know, he's boozing it up big time. He has no direction in his life. His wife says, you either stop drinking or I divorce you. So he says in this interview, he goes out golfing and drinking. He comes back home drunk as a skunk. And what do you know? His wife and his child, Jarrett Wright, who would become a major league pitcher in the mid-1990s, they're gone. So he tracks them down, and the wake-up call for him, they were in a van, and he goes to see Jarrett, and he wants to, you know, get Jarrett out of the van and talk to him and hug him and everything. Well, Jarrett, who is 3 years old at the time, locks the van door. So talk about a wake-up call when your own three-year-old son is joining the argument and saying, stop it, Dad, by locking you out of your own car. That is a sign that you need to make some changes. And thankfully for Clyde Wright and his family, he did. He has been reportedly alcohol-free since 1979. So going on, what's that, 38 years now. So congratulations to Clyde Wright, who was facing, the ultimate decision, the ultimate ultimatum right then and there. His wife and family had packed up and they were ready to move. And his three-year-old son is locking him out of his own car. You know, I don't want to deal with you, Dad. And for Wright, Clyde Wright, that was enough to become sober. And the good news is that he is still sober to this day. And according to several reports, still lives just a few blocks from what is now Angels Stadium. Of course, it was Anaheim Stadium. It was expanded to, 54,000 seats to host the Rams in the 1970s and 80s and into the early 90s. After the 1994 earthquake, which did some damage to the stadium, the Walt Disney Company, which then owned the then Anaheim Angels, decided to renovate the stadium and brought it down to what you see now. And it is a beautiful stadium, even without the big A. Well, Clyde Wright is right down the street. He is still a community representative, a community ambassador for the team. He's lived in Anaheim, as I said, ever since the Angels have been there, since 1966. And by all accounts, he is doing extremely well, is clean and sober, which is great to hear. And as I mentioned, his son, Jarrett Wright, who locked him out during this rather climactic moment in the Wright family's history. Jarrett Wright turned out to be a pretty decent pitcher again from the mid-90s to the mid-2000s. I think he hung him up about 10 years ago. So Clyde Wright, even though he did have some moments in the sun, but also some rather dark times on and off the field, doing well nowadays in Anaheim, a son who had a successful Major League Baseball career and still involved with the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. Boy, the Angels have had a pretty interesting history, not just in ballpark, not just in uniforms, but certainly in names as well. They've had the most names that any baseball team has had that has existed in one city, I think. I'm sure you can go back in the history books and find somebody similar. But the Los Angeles Angels, nay California Angels, nay Anaheim Angels, now Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, Orange County, California. They are proud to still have Clyde Wright in the family, and that is very cool. And that's just a great story that goes with this great picture and this delightfully tacky 1972 Topps card, number 55. So your thoughts about 72 Topps? Like I said, it's a set that I think most collectors, even though it is tacky and it is gaudy, you kind of give it a pass. You do the old, oh, it's the 70s. And despite its faults, and there are a few, 72 Topps is still, for the most part, well-liked by fans. Comment on the 72 Topps set or the Clyde Wright story at our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. And again, pass along Wax and Gum Stains to all of your friends and let them know that we'll have a Flashback Friday episode. We went back to 81 Topps this past weekend. Curious to see which archive episode we dig up for this upcoming weekend. And of course, we will have the 83 Fleer packs. We've got two packs that we will put up for auction likely later this week. So keep an eye out for that on Wax and Gum Stains. Next week, we dive into a very interesting set. I think it's a very underrated set. A lot of people don't give it the credit that it's due, in my opinion. But while there are some very positive things about 73 Topps, there's some pretty glaringly awful things about it as well. Most notably, some of the action shots. But also, this would be the last set that Topps would produce in multiple series up until 1993. And of course, they would get burned for that in 1974. But we will take a look at the 1973 Topps set, warts and all, in our next new podcast that comes out next Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock Eastern. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Again, thank you so much for joining me today as we look through our big old binder of baseball cards. and make sure you join us next week for a brand new edition of Wax Ecstatic.